We're working through 1 Peter in the sermon series right now. 1 Peter was written in the mid-7th century, the mid-60s of the 1st century. Christianity has been around now for 30, 35 years. It's not distinct from Judaism, really. The number of people who identify as Christians is very, very small. All of that is happening within two contexts. The earliest Christians in and around Jerusalem, of course, were in a Jewish context. But when Christianity got outside the region that we now call Israel, it's in the belly of the beast that is the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is so different from everything Christianity calls people to be and to do. The Roman Empire is built on power. Whoever controls the army controls the empire. Within the context of what Peter is doing, he is addressing God's elect, God's chosen people, with the acknowledgement that you are scattered, dispersed, in a culture that's hostile to you, that doesn't understand your values, isn't sympathetic to your values, and is probably going to work to stamp out those values. I think the world that we're living in is getting a bit more and more, thank you, a bit more and more like the world into which the early Christian movement was set. We are in a context where the values that we talk about on Sunday are hard to carry into the workplace on Monday, because for some of you it's dog eat dog, for some of you it's such rigid competition, for some of you it's an unsafe workplace, for some of you in school settings it's people who mock, make fun of anything that you would say that smacks of. So I want to begin with a mental experiment, a very serious mental experiment with you, to set the interpretation of a text, and I think it will be easy to read, a text that's largely misinterpreted. We begin this way. Let's suppose that it's next Sunday morning, and as you drive up in your vehicle, single, mom, dad, kids, whatever, as you're walking toward the building, somebody steps up to you, flashes something that sort of looks like a badge, and tells you, I'm here to tell you that you can't go in there today. There's not going to be any worship. You have to turn around, get in your vehicle, go home. If you don't, you'll be arrested. There'll be no service here next Sunday or the foreseeable future. I think you'd think you've either met someone who is mentally unstable or that you have got to find the security team or an elder and have them call the police. Because we live in a country where there's freedom of worship and nobody has the right to step up and say you can't worship, you can't have a public assembly, and if you do go in, if you show up next week, you're going to be arrested or you're going to be thrown out of your apartment or your mortgage is going to be foreclosed. Now let's suppose you're a 22-year-old woman. You're single, you've just graduated from college, which means you have a lot of student loans. And you've been fortunate enough, because you have the right kind of degree and you did well in the interview, accepted by a local healthcare company into their management training program. And even during the 8 weeks of management training, you're going to be paid more than you thought you'd be able to or two of employment. But when you finish the 8 weeks, that's going to go up by 40%. It's a sweet gig. And so you're in the second week of training, and during a break, the guy who's running the break for about 20 people who are in the room says, if you don't mind, over here, and he walks into what really is just a little bit oversized storage room, and he closes the door behind him, and he puts his back against the door. And he says, you want this job, don't you? You say, well, yeah, it's a sweet job, and I really think I'm fortunate to be in. He moves toward you, and he begins to grope you. And he says, if you don't want to be washed out of training next week and lose this sweet gig, I'm planning a weekend trip. I want you to be my guest and go with me. Some of you are thinking, what do? You'd scream, you'd walk out, you'd tell the other people in the room, this predator has just, you might file a grievance through the company, you might call the police. I get that. Now then, you're a 30-year-old man, and you're married, you have a wife and two preschool children. You've been working for this company 3 or 4 years. You've done really well, and it's largely product representation and sales. And you're in a semi-annual meeting with the president of the company and the people who are doing jobs with you. They're all together in a large room. At a point, he picks up his cup of coffee, and he works to the second table where you're sitting in the third chair. He looks at you and says, you lost one of our biggest accounts last month. And he begins to curse you. And he humiliates you in front of your peers. And not accidentally at all, he slops about half the cup of his coffee onto some papers that you have in front of you and onto your clothes and into your open laptop and shorts it out. Let's change the setting. You're not in Brentwood. You're in Krasnodon. Krasnodon is a town of 1,000 people. It's a coal mining town in eastern Ukraine occupied by the Russians. Soldiers did meet people who were going in to a Baptist church for Sunday morning worship. And they didn't flash badges. They had guns strapped over their shoulders, and they said, turn around and go home or you'll be arrested. There will be no service here today. There will be no service here next Sunday. This building is closed. The Baptist church, the Churches of Christ, and the Pentecostal church all lost their registration week in that area of Ukraine, and no public assemblies are allowed for any of those groups. Who do you call? The security team? Well, they're the security. They have the guns. Do you call the elders of your church? What can they do against guns? And now then, it's not the 22-year-old woman who's in management training who has been groped and propositioned, told that she doesn't have a job if she doesn't comply. You're a 19-year-old girl, and you're just walking the street in Krasnodon. And two soldiers arrest you and take you to a basement building, and you're kept there for 4 days. And you're assaulted by more men than you can count. Let's change the scenario again. Let's put you back in the Greco-Roman world. It's much more like Krasnodon than it's like Brentwood. You have rights. It's a world in which you have no one to whom you can appeal for your protection, your right to worship. Your God is known to the Romans. He has no statue in the Pantheon. You not only might be put out of an apartment, you could be beaten, you could be killed. You're not a 22-year-old woman in management training. You're that 19 or 16 or 14-year-old girl. I'm going to try to do something this morning that's terribly difficult to do. I'm going to try to lay some groundwork for just how to interpret the Bible generally, and specifically a text today that is largely misinterpreted. It's misinterpreted by people on our religious left, liberals, to say, yeah, that's why we don't like anything about the Bible. That's why we don't have any faith in anything in the Bible, because it approves slavery, it endorses misogyny, it puts women at a disadvantage to be abused. Men have all the rights, power and money have all the rights, and the weak and the marginalized have none. But the other side, to the right, and this text has also been abused by virtue of the fact that people have said that, are we having bike trouble? People have said, yeah, that text is exactly the way it has to be in our families and in our culture and in our churches. Women don't have equal voice with men. Women can't speak out in a church service. Women can't lead a prayer. In family settings, a woman has to live under the thumb of a husband who makes all the decisions, even if it's money she brought into the marriage or money she makes from the job. Our social placement today, both like the one that Peter wrote to, we are chosen exiles, chosen, but exiles in a world that doesn't share our values on lots of things. And yet it's different. We have very different social structures in the 21st century, largely because of the Christianity that was introduced into the world in the first century and the gradual amelioration of society that it had in the 3rd and 4th century, in the Middle Ages, and to modern times, to where, at least what we think of as the Western countries, slavery is illegal. It's a crime. Women do have rights. Women can actually go to college. Women have rights to appeal under law for protection. So let's put our back into that world and interpret this text fairly. The place where Christians would be put to the test most severely is in what, if you notice on the title slide, I put the word household in scare quotes. Most of us, when we hear the word household, we think about, we just translate it to family as we think of family, mom, dad, and the kids, nuclear family. That's not what a household was in 1 Peter or in the time that the New Testament was written. A household was more like a small business or a mom-and-pop farm or a mom-and-pop store. It wasn't just mom, dad, and the kids, but it was any constellation of slaves that might be owned or clients and hired workers, and that might be 20, it might be 50. In the case of someone like Seneca, who was a very wealthy man in his time, that was over 300 people. That was his household. Not just blood family. And so during that period of time, Greeks and Romans operated their households under codes. Plato wrote one, it's in his Republic. Xenophon wrote one based on Plato's, reflects a lot of the same ideas. Aristotle, the great moralist of his time, he wrote one. And Plutarch and Seneca, they actually were writing household codes contemporary with Peter. They lived in the same generation and were writing their household codes. Here's how the household codes ran. All power is vested in the paterfamilias. The paterfamilias was usually the oldest man, but it was the man who had the money and the power, and everything was subservient to his will. His wife was not courted and wed because of love. He got a wife through family arrangements among peers roughly on his social level. And the wife came into the marriage understanding that even if her father sent a piece of land or some money in her dowry, it essentially became the man's now, and she couldn't do anything with it except as he approved it. And if they were part of the wealthier class, you see, Rome had about 5% of all of its citizens who were the aristocracy, the emperor's house and family, the senators, and the generals. 95% of the rest of the Roman citizens were tradesmen, craftsmen, farmers, school teachers, construction people. And then there's, by actual body count, another 30% to the population. They were slaves. Not one of them was a citizen. Not one of them had any expectation of being a citizen, and they had no rights at all. Other than the 5% where all the wealth and power were concentrated, the other 95% were living hand to mouth every day, and the slaves were living just at the mercy of the aristocrats and the plebes, the wealthier plebes, common people. And in that context, a slave was what Aristotle called a living tool. The owner of the slave could do with and to that slave anything he wanted to do, and there'd be no legal repercussions. There was no right of appeal. There were no courts the slave could appeal to protect himself. The owner of a slave could kill a slave without legal penalty. Most of the Christians were either slaves or from the lower classes of the citizen rung. When Paul writes to these Christians about their life in households, he's writing to them about a situation the like of which you've never experienced, and in the context in which you and I live, you wouldn't tolerate. You wouldn't tolerate someone meeting you at the door and saying, "You can't go into church. You can't have public assemblies and worship this Jesus person." If you're a 22-year-old single woman, you have rights, you have protections under the law. If you're a young father working for a company and you are humiliated and abused, your property destroyed, hot coffee poured on you, you have legal recourse. You know you do. In that culture, they couldn't imagine having recourse. They couldn't imagine what 2, 3, 8, 20 centuries of Christian religion having influence in the Western world, at least, have made possible even under civil law. The situation that Peter describes is one where the gospel would have revolutionized the structures of the society. But as long as these household codes were in place, Christians had to live with them. And that's what Peter is writing about when he writes today's text. He's not telling you what to do in your situation or what would be okay in 21st century America. He's telling folks who've been thrown into the lion's den of having to live in a very hostile culture by values the culture repudiates. Remember, what is the value of Rome? Power. What's the value of Christian faith? Love. Love that shows itself as compassion and gentleness and kindness. Taking care of the weak, feeding the hungry, lifting up the poor and the marginalized. Those were on the vice lists of the Romans, because that simply meant those people had been fated. That was the word. They were fated to be slaves. They were fated to be poor. They were fated to be prostitutes. They were fated to be sexually abused, abused as workers. That was their fate. Actually, I think today's text probably needs to start back up at about verse 11. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles, I need to start by reminding you we're living in a very hostile culture, church. And if you keep living to the standards that you're familiar with as pagans, that's going to cancel out your faith. But if you live your faith, it may make your life worse. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us. All of you know, Peter's telling them, that life's not fair as you're having to live it, because all of his readers were poor. The vast majority were slaves. Some of them were women. He says, life's not fair for you. 13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors, etc., etc. And the word submit occurs there for the first of three times. So I think the text starts there. Is the emperor a fair man? He's Nero. Is the emperor good? Is the emperor kind? No, the emperor's a tyrant. The emperor is abusive. The emperor has a retinue around him of yes people who will let him do anything he wants to, and he does everything that he wants to that you can think of that today we'd call sordid. But that's the model for power. Now to our text in 18. Slaves. Every household code started with advice to slaves. The advice was always given to the master, not to them. And what was said in those household codes, even the one by Seneca, was remember to keep them in line. Remember that every slave needs a good beating every once in a while just to be reminded of who's in charge. Slaves, in reverent fear of God, submit yourselves to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, a very rare person that would have been, but also to those who are harsh. For it's commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they're conscious of God. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, that's commendable before God. Pause there. Paul says, slaves, the life situation you're in is unjust, it is unfair, it is ungodly. But Christian religion has no power to change social structures. So what we tell our members is, don't try to change the social structures. You can't. It'll get you killed. But don't sabotage your master's farm or his workshop. Be better at whatever you're assigned to do than you would have been otherwise. I know it's not fair, and sometimes you're going to get a beating, even because not only have you done good work, you have been a good person. And he has seen you in being kind as being weak, and so he beats you. He said there's certainly no virtue if you do try to sabotage his work or do something that's really bad and he punishes you for it. So there's no virtue in that. So what's the counsel to slaves? Know that God is aware you're living in an unjust, unfair situation. Make the best of it. Bite your tongue. Try to honor God by showing even your cruel master the character of Christ that might touch his heart at some point. Now let's skip a block that we're going to come back to. Let's go to the start of chapter 3. We'll see the third time the word submit. Wives, in the same way, submit yourselves to your own husbands, so that if any of them don't believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives. Were women in unjust, unfair, almost want to say unlivable situations in their day? Yes. They had a little more status than a slave, but all the power was with men. Maybe you can win over those pagan husbands, not by having a Bible study with him, and not by arguing with him. That'd probably just get you a beating. But maybe you'll win them over without words by your behavior when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty shouldn't come from outward adornments such as elaborate hairstyles and wearing the gold jewelry or fine clothes. Not many of them would have had that anyway. Rather, let your beauty be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Your husband may not value it. He may see that you're now more a patsy than you were before, and you're even more. But he's, submit, be gentle. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to adorn themselves. They submitted themselves to their husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her Lord. That's not in the Hebrew text of the Old Testament. It's in the Septuagint. Once she calls him Lord, he hands her over to a harem. You say, well, I wouldn't tolerate it. Of course you wouldn't tolerate it. But in the ancient Near East, you tolerated a lot of things if you were a woman, or you were a child, or you were a slave, not because it was fair, and certainly not because God wanted it that way, but because that's the way it was. You're her daughters, you're Sarah's daughters, if you do what's right and don't give way to fear. You say, but I am afraid of what he could do to me. Yeah, but your ultimate Lord who loves you is Christ. And then notice, there's just a one verse throwaway to husbands. And I think that's because probably Peter knew there weren't many men, husbands, paterfamilias, heads of households, who would be reading this letter, because, as Paul said, most of the Christians are slaves and they're poor and they're not powerful. They don't have power. And this may almost be an in-your-face to those pagans who are abusing their wives and beating their slaves. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner, not physically, not emotionally weaker so much as they just don't have power. You know you can do whatever you want to. They're in the weak position. But if you are a Christian, treat them with respect, knowing that they don't have power, but they're heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. One historian writes to the role of women and the impact of Christianity. The Christian message provided a much better prospect for women than the pagan world could. For a start, there would be more women. Girls in particular, but the Christians infanticide. The consequent shortage of world and the surplus of them in the Christian world resulted in a lot of marriages between Christian women and pagan men who might either convert or at least give consent for their children to be brought up as Christians. You know where the idea for domestic abuse shelters arose for women who were mistreated like these women? Christian sentiment. Christians established those. Why? Because they believed what Peter said, that women are joint heirs with life with men, that males and females are both in the image of God. Romans didn't believe that. Greeks didn't believe that. Males were superior by fate, by birth, by privilege. Women were sort of toys and playthings. They were breeding. But they're not what we are. You know, who wrote laws to protect women and children? Child labor laws. Lobbied against slavery. William Wilberforce. Christians. Made it possible for a woman to work without a man's permission in a public marketplace. A woman to go to college. Law school. Med school. When I was president of a college in Michigan, we did an honor, part of it for the city, honoring the first woman ever to be admitted to the University of Michigan Medical School, not while I was there, but a number of years before, who lived in that little town, a breakthrough that in the 20th century, a woman could go to medical school in the state of Michigan. You know where it came from? Christian sentiment, largely in that case, pressure from the Methodist Church. Christians of the late first and certainly into the second and third centuries, they turned the tables on the household codes and the larger cultural values of the Greco-Roman world that devalued and dehumanized women, and we haven't done enough yet. We think we worked through a really serious problem lately to let women read the Bible or pray or speak from a platform in this church. People have used First Peter 3 to say this is why women shouldn't. They've always got to be under the thumb of men. Peter is writing to folks in Krasnodar, saying in Krasnodar, you don't have the rights you should have because you've got a boot on your neck. Peter is writing to, my wife told me not to say it this way, but she's not in the room. I can give better advice to you than Peter could. Because our cultural situation is different. I can tell the person who's being abused in the workplace, who's being discriminated against for employment, who's being whatever, go to the union rep at your company. Call the police. Come to the elders of the church. They know who the lawyers are in the body. We'll come to your defense. Peter is not saying the household codes of the Greeks and Romans are good, live with them. He's saying, bite your tongue for the moment. Because until the presence of Jesus permeates the society, there's still going to be a lot of injustices. Rubel, are you sure that's exactly what the text means? You know the part I said I'm skipping? Let's go back to it. Go back to 1 Peter 3 and pick up at verse 21. To this you were called. Remember what we read? Slaves. You're going to have to put up with a lot, especially if you've got a harsh master. Women, you're going to put up with a lot. To this you were called. Here's why that's being asked of you. Not because Christianity is oppressive and we still want it to be that way in the 21st century. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. That's Isaiah 53. This whole text is built on Isaiah 53. What happened to Jesus? Injustice. What happened to Jesus? Unfairness. What happened to Jesus? Under the code of time and place, he lost his life. He suffered, and he had no recourse. Slaves, women, you don't have recourse any more than Jesus did. When they hurled their insults at him, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he'd made no threats. See, that was the temptation to them in their culture. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you've been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you've returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Christ suffered. He is the ultimate suffering servant. When this happened to him, justice, Isaiah said, would be denied him. Sure enough, what did Pilate say? I don't find any fault in him, but this is too much for me to bother with. Kill him. Are you surprised that in that Roman culture, slaves got abused? And women and children had no rights? and that it was a real stretch to say, if you are a husband, if you are a head of a household, be considerate. He doesn't even say, be loving. He just says, sort of be fair. Christians today in Saudi Arabia, if we were sent down by teletransport into Saudi Arabia today, a lot of you women would very quickly have to take earrings or a necklace, anything that has a cross. That's illegal. Wear that outside a private place in Saudi Arabia, you're subject to arrest. North Korea, try to find a Baptist church, Church of Christ, Pentecostal church, North Korea today. There are a few state registered churches that are called Christian churches, but the pastor is appointed by the state and he will not preach Jesus, he'll preach the head of the government. Or Ukraine, there are situations that you this week, maybe a student that, I don't know if it's a biology class or an essay you write, if you just mention creation sympathetically, you might lose 10 points or your paper might be failed or turned back for a rewrite because this science class, we don't do this God stuff in here. And students have brought me their papers. If you're a vulnerable woman in a workplace, the reason I use the illustration of being called into the storage room, a friend of mine was raped in the storage room, not by a trainer, but by her boss, but by a salesman who had come by while the boss was out of the office. The Bible does not endorse slavery. The Bible does not endorse misogyny. The Bible does not defend the right of men to take advantage of women. The Christian faith is what started the process of saying, males and females are both in the image of God, and to be considerate and respectful and to affirm against your culture the value of the other person, the worth of the other person, the dignity of the other person. That's God's will. Dark text today, a little bit. But it's the text, church, that we're supposed to read to say in our own time and place when we see Christian values being trampled. We do what's right. Jesus did. He paid a price. You and I may. But Jesus set an example that to do right, it's worth suffering. Stand for the benediction and we'll leave. Here's the benediction. It's a bright benediction. It's a benediction that says God is going to be with you in the settings this week where you may be tested, you may be tempted, you may be required to live an alternate lifestyle because of your faith. It's the ancient blessing the Lord asked to be pronounced over Israel. The Lord bless you and keep you in all the places you're going to go this week, the places you'll be, your classrooms, your offices, your workplaces. The Lord make His face shine on you. A face shining on someone means favor, blessing. You know that He's with you. The Lord make His face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn His face toward you. Know that the Lord will always be watching you. Not to find fault, but say, this is my child. I'm interested. I'm going to protect. May the Lord turn His face toward you and give you His shalom, His peace. May it be so. God bless you. Have a great week. Thanks for being here.